Welcome to the Corporate Venturing Insider Series, where I interview top practitioners in the CVC world and learn with you the best practices and golden nuggets that they have accumulated over their career. In this episode, we will be learning from Rohini, Managing Partner at New Build VC. Rohini, could you take a few minutes to share your story and how you got to where you are today?
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. So my journey into corporate venture, so maybe I'll just go back a little bit further. Before I got into venture, I am an engineer by training, came to the US as a grad student, and I came to the Bay Area to work in networking. I joke that it was the AI of the 90s. So I worked as a network engineer, hardware design, chip design, board design at a company called Bay Networks. And then I went to business school at MIT Sloan. So I went to Sloan to get my MBA, and which is where I was exposed to a lot of entrepreneurship. I was part of the MIT 50K, and I was part of the first MIT VC conference. So really got to know about venture and startups while I was at Sloan. And I actually got into venture through an introduction from a classmate of mine. So one of my classmates had worked at Intel before she came to Sloan. And as we were talking about all the things I was interested in and so on, and she's like, you should think about Intel Capital. She made that introduction, and I was fortunate enough to join as an associate. I was called an investments manager. I started in 99. And so it was still in the middle of the boom. And so I joked that I saw the boom and the bust within a year and a half of joining venture. So a lot of what I learned was at Intel Capital. So I was at Intel Capital for 7 years, so 99 through 06, and really invested through a cycle and got to see a lot of innovation that happened in that first cycle. So post the dot-com bust and pre-cloud. So as mobile was happening, wireless was happening, I was in the middle of a lot of those things. And then I had a second stint in corporate venture as part of NGP Capital, which is Nokia's venture arm later. But in between, I was at NEA for almost 9 years, investing as an institutional venture investor in enterprise investing. And now I'm a managing partner of a venture firm called New Build Venture Capital, which also has some elements of corporate investing in it. So happy to kind of dig into any of those things. And maybe just a minute on the New Build idea is that we do want to work with corporate LPs, and we have this view that there is a model that you can build with multi-corporates investing in innovation that is further out. So when you're thinking about eyes and ears innovation, finding these ideas that you can actually discover more if you have other corporate LPs around the table who are also searching for similar ideas, and you have an experienced set of investors leading the charge on making those investments. So we'll come back and talk about that, but I have been fortunate enough to see corporate venturing over 20 plus years. And I really think it's an interesting and very differentiated part of venture. And it is a growing part of venture. So I'm really excited to have this conversation.
Thank you. I think one thread that's obvious is technology. From engineering background, even the business school in MIT is kind of technology. And then Intel Capital, NEA, NGP, and even today what you do, there's this one thread. So maybe you could talk about the value of your engineering background combined with the business school. How does that make you a better investor?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I still think of myself very much as a fairly technical product market investor. I really enjoy the business of technology, and that's where I've been in my entire career. I've spent my entire career trying to understand what technology innovation means, what economic cost points does it enable, but also there's a big element of communities in technology. The adoption of technology is not dependent just on the invention, it's also dependent on the demand side, where, you know, who is receiving it and who is enabling it. And part of the MIT background is relevant to that as well, because we really do study technologies that will get cheaper over time, or we're dealing with things where marginal cost is zero in software, like you can make more units without having additional costs and so on. So that intersection of new technology, new economic cost points, and new usage or new communities, that has been the area where I have been most interested in over my career and continue to do so.
So I think you were very lucky indeed with Intel Capital, one of the top CVCs even today. So it's still doing so well and so impactful. And you did a boom and bust, which I think many investors who are recent in VC or CVC haven't had an experience of bust. You had it very quickly in your career. Can you share a bit about what it was the first 2-3 years at Intel Capital and your early learnings?
When I first joined Intel Capital, this was 99, there were probably almost 100 investors. And Intel Capital over time has gotten to that size and shrunk over time. I don't know exactly how many there are now. You know, I joined straight out of business school and I was trying to figure out like how this whole system works and what investing is all about. And it turned out to be a very good training ground, right? So at that time, the leader of Intel Capital was Les Vadez, who was a very early, he was, I think, employee number 4 at Intel. He had a lot of gravitas within Intel and essentially had created Intel Capital a few years before that. So I think around 94 or 95. With this idea that there was an ecosystem around Intel. So Intel is a component company. And yes, there's a software ecosystem, but I think there was also this idea that as a manufacturing company, you needed to have a supply chain that you were actually investing in. So a lot of the early Intel Capital investments had been in semiconductor manufacturing, smaller suppliers, trying to capitalize them and so on. By the time I got there, there was a lot more of this ecosystem thinking idea. And there was this move towards servers, which was new. And Intel was starting to think about what is the software ecosystem that needs to go around that. And a lot of investments were around that. So when I first joined Intel, what we were tasked with was to start exploring the space on what is the landscape around Intel and how could we use investment as a way for us to be much more tightly integrated or maybe incentivize people to actually include Intel as part of their product lines and so on. It turned out that I had a background in networking, so I pretty quickly got pulled into a lot of the networking. And my first couple of years, as we went through the bust, Intel Capital actually shrank. So there were many people who left. There were probably a couple of rounds of layoffs even at that point. This is in the 2000 area. And I inherited a number of investments as well from people who had made those investments prior to leaving Intel Capital. Would you continue the investment you're making? That triage actually taught me a lot about investing. The other piece of it was it eventually led to my joining the Wi-Fi group. So around 2003, most of the activity migrated to Wi-Fi, networking activity migrated to Wi-Fi. And Intel, if you remember at that time, came out with this platform called Centrino, which was a way to actually start including the Wi-Fi capability on the client side. Networking has a classic chicken and egg problem, right? Somebody has to either build a cellular network and then you bring in the phones, or in that case, Intel actually reversed the strategy, which was to say, let's forward price and make sure there are clients available. In this case, there were laptops with Wi-Fi, and that enabled the creation of the network side. And then that also, eventually I migrated to thinking more about the WAN at that point. There was a technology attempt called WiMAX, and many people might remember that. And it was really informed by the success of Wi-Fi. Wi-Fi introduced a number of interesting technology innovations. So for example, the physical layer, for the first time, there was OFDM that became part of wireless networks. So at that time, cellular networks were still in the GSM and CDMA world. And WiMAX was this thought process that said, maybe at this OFDM physical layer change, maybe you could also migrate to an IEEE standards type change rather than the GSM world at that point. So we were very active. I call it the anthropology of standards committees. How do you standardize a technology? How do you work with other counterparties with very different contexts and maybe geographical interests and so on? And then also, how do you enable an ecosystem around that? And because I was always working on these cutting edge programs, I also got to be part of Intel had these things called SLURPs, the strategic long range planning cycles. And I got to participate in a couple of those, interacting with various people from other parts of Intel. And that sort of goes back to your point about how do you bring some of this learning back into the mothership?
I think you're the first one in over 80 podcasts to actually talk about the mothership, the corporate VC, and the standards activity. So I don't know if you know, but my very first job was in standards.
Okay.
And so I'm really curious about some of the best practice or insights you got from, because we are not talking about enabling an ecosystem here. We're talking about unlocking an ecosystem. Like Wi-Fi did not exist.
Yeah.
You have the chicken and egg situation.
Yeah.
How do you unlock it in a way that it's not just you create the technology on both device and network,
yeah,
but you also start the work of standardization early enough that it actually can have impact. Can
yeah.
you talk about these coordinations between corporate venturing and standardization?
No, I think there is a lot of discovery that happens. There are patterns, of course, that you can recognize in these things. For a brief period, I was a voting member of 802.16. You know, so you actually become a voting member by attending. You attend a certain number of meetings and then you get a vote, right? So it's not based on your company. Like, you have to be there personally to do that. You know, I think the standards process, a couple of things that I learned along the way were, it's really a very democratic process in some way. Everybody's doing their own thing. They have an interest in creating a larger ecosystem, let's say. And what the standards really do are, they are effectively defining interfaces. So you can innovate within a box, but then the interfaces between those boxes are defined. And going back to networking, there was the OSI stack, if you remember, right, which was all about that. You essentially take layers and you essentially say, these are the interfaces between layers. And therefore, you can have various actors, whether they're large companies or small companies, IP block vendors, or in later on, open source. You can create better methods within that box. You can create a better physical layer. But how it interacts with the next layer up is very well defined, and that's open, right? So the open part of the standards bodies are that. But you, in order to figure out what that standard interface needs to be, you know, it is, the standards process takes the approach that you want it to be somewhat future-proof, right? So that you can capture the best available technology at that time. So it is a very interesting process. So that's the intent. But then there is an anthropology to standards. There you go attend these standards meetings. There are all people standing in these corners, and there's a lot of horse trading that's happening.
If you don't have standards, you don't allow for innovators to come in and innovate within the interface. So yeah. I also want to talk about another thing you mentioned before we move to your transition to NEA.
Yeah.
You inherited portfolio companies
yeah.
during your time at Intel Capital. And there's this concept of commitment escalation. You've invested in the company, you really like the entrepreneurs, so of course you want to do the follow investment. But that's not true when you inherit a portfolio company. You're looking at it with fresh eyes.
Fresh eyes, yeah.
Can you speak to what you've learned from this experience which you are using today?
Well, absolutely. That's a great question. And actually, fast forward to NEA, I had a couple of those fresh looks as well. Yes, I think this was true of Intel Capital even at that time. It was an investment committee type of process. So there, Les was on the investment committee and eventually like John Miner and Arvind Sudam. There were other people on the investment committee. And then was somebody from Treasury, and because we were investing off the balance sheet. And there was somebody who looked at it from a legal perspective. But really, it came down to the investment managers to think through, like, why are we making this investment? What is the case for investment? So when I inherited a number of these companies, I usually would see the reasoning behind the investment and what the reasoning was. And my thought process was to just figure out what things had changed and what things were still the same. Meaning, if you had invested in a faster telco chip in 2000, you had to take a bet on whether the telco market was coming back. Mm. And so there were some things that kind of became obvious. But so we looked at one high level, is the opportunity set still intact? Two, do they have customers or do they have a plan where this is a viable offering that they're providing? And three, what about the team? Like, because you had a lot of people churn as well, right? Where people who went through the 90s, and I think we're seeing the same thing now, there is going to be a churn of, there's a generational transition that happens whenever you have these things, as well as people on the cap table. There were a number of venture firms who no longer would want to invest, right? So even if I wanted to invest further in a company, if their entire cap table were not going to invest in a company, then it didn't matter. So you had to really think through the product, the market, the people, and the cap table, and then understand, okay, whether this is... and then the additional thing we had was, does this matter to Intel? And I think, to be very honest, one of the powers of Intel Capital at that time and throughout was that there was a little bit of air gapping on that, to say, work and try to figure out whether this company will succeed or not, because let's not over-rotate on what Intel needs.
That's a good nugget.
Exactly. Right. So I do think that financial return is a good way to think about what is the success of this investment program going to be. And then you put an additional strategic lens on it. And yeah, so that's how we did the fresh look at it.
Which is very good. But it also means you're very thorough with this fresh look.
Yes.
Which potentially comes with a signal issue, which is if you do decide not to invest, it's a very thoughtful decision. It's not just you decide not to follow. You've decided for very good reasons not to follow, which is a signal to the other investors. How do you handle that?
Yeah, I think at Intel Capital, we were not lead investors at that point. For the most part, we were joining syndicates. There were a few where we were lead investors. And so I think when you're a lead investor, that's a much stronger signal. Yeah. But it's also good for the lead investor to be thorough like that, right? To actually say, this is, we are trying to create this. If you decided not to follow and you had good reasons for that, if you were not the lead investor and you communicated well with the company, yes, they're disappointed with it, but I think there are ways to handle it. If you are the lead investor, and if it seems erratic to the company and to your cap table, then it becomes very hard to continue to be the lead investor. Right. Because there is this expectation that you have to, when in doubt, like, what do you do? Because there's a big gray area. There are some companies which are clearly like, this is not working. Like, you can say, okay, let's figure out an exit path. But in between, that is the hard part. And even when you're the sort of the large, you might be the largest investment fund, but resources are not infinite. You still have to go through that process of trying to figure out, how do you make decisions when all the data is not there, right? What you think are the risks.
Yep.
And then you see whether those risks panned out or not, right? And the same thing is true for the fresh look, right? Where you say there are some risks that have been taken off the table, they've been de-risked. Some new risks have come on board. So can we re-underwrite it in this way? And typically you can have that same conversation with the entrepreneurs. And so sometimes it might be a valuation conversation, right? And when I was at NEA, I was a fresh look on Luxtera. So Forrest had invested in Luxtera. And actually the company was at that point active optical cables. Eventually it became part of the optical backplane for server systems and so on. But the bet the company had taken was that there would be a transition from copper to optical. That bet, people have been trying to take that over the last 20 years, because everybody knows that eventually there a lot of interconnects will be optical, but when exactly that happens?
Exactly. It's not the if, it's a when.
It's the when, like the market timing. So when in 2009, when I was a fresh look, when we re-underwrote Luxtera, we felt like the technology was fantastic. The team was still motivated. We had a great cap table, but we had missed the market. Didn't mean like there was another downturn. The copper to optical change was not happening at that point. And we thought it might be another 3 years out. It actually turned out to be another several more years after that. Yep. When we did that, we said part of re-underwriting this has to be that the valuation has to be set, right? So I think you have to bring everybody along. If you're the lead investor, in the Luxtera case, we were one of the lead investors, August Capital, Seven Rosen. And when I was at Intel Capital, it was more about communicating internally and with the entrepreneur, like, what is your thought process? Why is this not going to happen. In the case of when you're a lead investor at NEA, you have to now explain more thoroughly like what you're doing and if it is going to be, yes, we're going to re-underwrite this, but at a different valuation, you also have to explain that. So I think the best you can do is explain it, and you may be unpopular at some point, but I think the best way to do it is to really think in terms of those bets and explain it and say, this is how we think about it.
So maybe like my last question on fresh look, because it's such an important concept. Do you see value for this to be institutionalized in the VC firm where it's always a new person looking into an existing investment, or do you think it doesn't have to be?
I don't think that has to be, right? I would say that you can build an internal culture within a venture firm. So I would say for the most part, it can't be a fresh person. I think it is too disruptive to have this because the entrepreneur needs a tribe around them. If you continue to believe in that entrepreneur, it's better for you to be around them than somebody who's in their face saying you're not going to be. So I don't think engineering an adversarial fresh look process is the best approach because ultimately you're fighting with incomplete information, right? If you believe you might be too Pollyanna-ish, you might make a decision where there was not enough data to actually support it. But if you build a too adversarial system, then you might essentially overlook opportunities that were there because nobody can prove anything to anyone when it's so early. So I think the process has to be somewhere between like rubber stamp, like it can't be that. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it should be adversarial. It has to be something in the middle where it has to be thorough and dispassionate, right? Somewhat dispassionate. You know, so you could have some of those things, and it's certainly appropriate to have a partner who comes along with you for the ride and then also counsels you, like if you're too far gone on one side or the other. So adding a partner for a fresh look and having that be a consultative process. And I think that is probably the best in the middle.
No, I really like your granular view because the first investment, there's so much you don't know, despite all the due diligence you can do. The follow, you have so much more information, but then you start to have emotion and bias. Yeah. And I think what you're proposing, which is a fresh look while complementing with the best information you have, is probably how you make the best.
You have some new information, but it might still be very incomplete.
Yeah.
Right. So I think these are the three things we should do. Like we should call customers. Like we should have another partner do reference checks.
Yeah.
Let's talking to the employees or the management team, even market view, like how much of a fresh look do you do versus a company where you really have to now lead again. And so I think definitely it is worthwhile to have a little bit more of a process for it.
No, I think your point about being more collaborative than adversarial is very important. And to have the person bringing the fresh look, being the one interviewing the customers, reassessing the assumptions made, I think is really a golden nugget.
Yeah.
Now I want to move to your move. So you moved from one of the best CVCs with a formidable mothership to one of the very best tech VC in the world, at NEA. So can you talk about what motivated the change, but more importantly, what it is that you were surprised once you joined NEA?
Yeah. So what motivated the move? I think at some point during the Intel journey, I did a little bit of my own self-analysis and said, which part of this do you like more? The two paths that seemed obvious were either growing within Intel, like you keep growing within Intel and maybe go into the business units and take on more strategy roles or things like that, or be an investor, be a professional investor over time. So I decided that I was more in that second camp. I enjoy investing. And that's what I wanted to do for the rest of my career. That was a thought process. And I got to know Kittu Kaluri, who was just joining NEA. He had been an entrepreneur. He was at NeoTerrace and the NetScene, Juniper. And I actually met him at an alumni lunch. Like there was a professor. So we went to the same undergrad college in India. And I hadn't known him before then, but basically we went to this alumni lunch and we were talking at the lunch and he's like, where are you right now? I said, I've spent 6 or 7 years at Intel Capital. This is the type of thing I do. he called me a little bit later and said, well, I'm actually joining NEA. Would you like to come and join NEA? So that was how the process started. And I was leaning towards being an investor for a long time, and you could continue to do that other parts. But that's how it started.
Let me have a question about Bolt, because you mentioned Kitoo, and we co-invested in the same company in Boston, MetaLens. Last week, we had a board meeting, and Kitoo is exceptional in asking very few questions, but really the question that matters. So do you have any golden nuggets about how you contribute to a board for better decision-making? What's your superpower in a board?
What I have figured out about my own board presence and so on, I really enjoy this product market fit stage. But there are like these phases to a company. So the best thing to know is, where is this company in its own development cycle? Mm-hmm. And some of it is linear and some of it is like iterative. So you need to figure out where that is. So at that stage of the initial stages of the company, often the board member is an extension of the team, right? So you're effectively, if you had this, again, the spectrum of governance versus part of the team, like you're very much towards part of the team. And I think most helpful is like when you can use the board meeting as a strategy session, right? So product market fit, right? What is the business model? Who are the potential customers? And you're trying to iterate with what the company is seeing on a month-to-month basis. As the company grows, then you sort of have to morph your own role as well. Yeah. There are usually more people around the table, right? And also more people on the company side. And you don't want the board member to be like viewed as an operating, like, don't tell me what to do type of thing. So you morph more towards being in council. And I think you also start asking more governance type questions, because then you're starting to work off of data more than signals, smaller signals. And then eventually, as it gets closer and closer to an IPO or an exit of some sort, you are worrying about the system. So you're starting to think about, do we have a CFO? What are the systems you're putting in place and so on? So I think the board role has to change. Like, you have to have the flexibility to change that.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's a perfect transition for my final question, which is, what about new build? What are you most excited to invest in the next year or so?
Absolutely. Thank you. No, and it directly relates to it. It's been a wonderful conversation, by the way. Thank you for these great questions. So new build is really a continuation from what we were working on at NGP. So maybe a generalization of that, right? And so my partner, Chad Bailey, and I were both at NGP. He worked more on the supply chain. Private wireless went into these supply chain type use cases, and he was investing in that application layer. And I was looking much more at this infrastructure connection relating back to cloud and AI and data and so on. We were doing this in the context of 5G. So through this 5G keyhole, we saw that supply chain was very, very important. As the pandemic rolled through, we had this realization that this is a gigantic market, right? So if you look at the front half of enterprise, like you look at marketing, sales, customer service, and all of those things, but you look at the back half of enterprise, in what we think of broadly as a supply chain, it runs at a lot of old software. They're on a lot of systems, old systems that were written 20, 30 years ago, right? A lot of these systems were written before there was cloud, before there was AI, before there was even GPS, right? So our belief is that over the next 10 years or next 20 years, the back half of the enterprise is going to grow much faster, right? And there is going to be this architectural transition to the cloud, to AI, and so on. So anything from procurement to manufacturing software to distribution, warehouses, logistics, payments, supplier intelligence, there is an architectural shift happening which will unlock $1 trillion of value. And so that's kind of, we're very much focused on that.
Well, Rohini, it was wonderful to have you, and you shared so many golden nuggets from your journey, from investing, from being on the board, from innovation rails. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. Look forward to listening to this podcast.